Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 29th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, talking about all of Chicago's sports teams while having a very special guest on, somebody here from the Chicagoland area. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the Tinley Park area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can visit them at the Tinley Park Downs Shopping Center at 7913 171st Street in Tinley Park, or give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. Well, we'll start off today talking about the Cubs. Camp is in session in Arizona. Should be very exciting now that the baseball season is coming around. Right now, though, I want to focus on someone who I have been highly critical of in the past. Someone who I feel is a bust because, in my opinion, he has not contributed enough to justify the fact that he was taken in the first round by the Cubs. The person that I am talking about is Kyle Schwarber. Now, some of you might think that I've gone bat crap crazy. I mean, come on, he's shown up to camp, he's much lighter, more quicker, he's mastering his skills in the outfield, which is something that needs to happen because his outfield play, by the way, is atrocious, but that's for another time. So why am I bashing Kyle Schwarber so much? He's done everything he could do to get better. Well, let's put it this way. Just because he lost all this weight doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to become a better ball player this season. Now, I will say this. Last year for him was pretty much rock bottom. So no, he can't get any worse, but can he get any better is the question. Just to remind you about what he did last season, taking a look at some of his stats. Sure, 30 home runs in limited time, that's awesome, but what I'm not too crazy about is that 211, 315, 467 slash line for an OPS of 782. That slash line itself is horrendous, and combining that with the fact that this guy spent time in AAA, the quote-unquote 2016 World Series hero, the guy who came up in 2015 and made some noise later in the season to propel the Cubs into the playoffs, even hitting a clutch home run in the wild card game against the Pirates. When analyzing all of those accolades and thinking about how much Kyle Schwarber has meant to this team over these past couple of seasons, it's unbelievable to think that he was in AAA last year because he couldn't hit a major league pitcher. So, if you want to argue here and say that, okay, Schwarber's lost so much weight, he's in new shape, he's going to really contribute this season, maybe hit 240 or 250, and that's really pushing it. But if you want to sit there and think that Kyle Schwarber is going to make a comeback and that he's going to become so successful, fine, that's your choice. But I know one thing about Cubs fans, because I'm one myself, and that's the fact that people do not know when to give up on others. My point being, everybody hung on to Mark Pryor and Kerry Wood, Augie Ojeda, Kevin Orrick. Everybody thought that these guys were going to be special, and they never wanted to say that they were busts because they were ashamed to say that word. Well, I'll tell you something right now. If you want to sit here and claim that Kyle Schwarber is going to be a better player because he's lost some weight, I have a perfect person to draw some parallels to and to show you just how wrong and flawed that argument is. That person, in his first full season in the major leagues, finished 7th in the MVP voting with the San Francisco Giants. But since that year, he has never hit above 320 in a season, and his trajectory, his career trajectory that is, has continued to spiral downward. The person I'm talking about is Pablo Sandoval, third baseman. Now, he used to be with the Giants, as I mentioned, after that amazing year in which he hit 330 with 25 homers and 90 RBIs. His numbers plummeted and took a hit. He hit 268 with 13 homers. That year, by the way, he came into Giants camp with 20 more pounds on him. And their trainers and their nutritional staff were stunned. They couldn't believe that Sandoval allowed himself to get this much out of shape and then show up at camp and think that everything would be okay. After that year, he went on a nutrition program, came back, hit 315, 23 homers, 70 RBIs, and the year after hit 283, no problems. Then, he gained some more weight, hit 278, then 279, and then hit free agency. His camp at that time said, you know what, we promise you, Pablo is not going to gain any more weight. He's going to stay at the weight that he's at. He's going to be in shape and ready to go for spring training. Therefore, the Red Sox decided to take a chance on him and gave him a massive payday. That payday originally was $17.6 million, and this year it's going to increase to $18 million, even though he's not on the Red Sox anymore. He's on the Giants again, fighting for a major league spot on a minor league invite to spring training. Why is he not on the Red Sox anymore? Well, his first year in Boston, he hit .245, a .658 OPS, with only 10 home runs, and he gained more weight. Although his camp said no, he'll be fine for spring training. The minute he signed his name on that dotted line, he gained more weight and became horrible at the game, and as I mentioned today, is fighting to stay on a major league team. So how does this all relate to Kyle Schwarber? Well, just because Schwarber lost some weight and looks like he's in shape and feels rejuvenated and is ready to go, don't buy it just yet, because I'll tell you one thing. Based on the narrative of Pablo Sandoval, which is eerily similar to Kyle Schwarber's, I don't expect him to come right in, waltzing in for that matter, and just start improving his performance at the speed of light. Sure, there's a possibility that Schwarber this year is going to have some sort of renaissance. He'll hit maybe .250, bash 32 or 33 home runs, and have nearly 100 RBIs. Don't buy it, though. Just because this year is going to go well, that doesn't mean the rest of his career is going to go just as planned. If there's one thing that you want to take away from this segment, please remember the narrative of Pablo Sandoval. Because I'll tell you something, just because Schwarber does well this year, or because he comes to camp rejuvenated, doesn't mean a thing. He doesn't feel like he's in the driver's seat right now, and he has no right to be. He was sent to AAA last year. That was a humbling experience. He needed to come back quicker and with less weight on him. But come next season, after a great year this year, for example, he's going to put on more weight. He's not going to think about the repercussions. And because of that, he's going to let everyone down. That's why don't count on Kyle Schwarber just yet. Wait it out. And more importantly, remember Pablo Sandoval, because that could happen to Schwarber himself. On a final note that's somewhat related to the Cubs, Jake Arrieta is still a free agent. How crazy is that? The Cubs had an offer on the table for him before picking Darvish. Arrieta scoffed at it, claiming that it wasn't enough money. And now today, as spring training has already been in session for about a week and a half, he is not on a major league ball club. And although there are discussions about Arrieta, about where he's going to go, there are rumors circulating left and right, the point is, he is not on a major league team. How crazy is that? The Cubs had an offer, a concrete one, more so, and he didn't take it, saying it wasn't enough money. The Cubs ended up signing Darvish and totally disregarded Arrieta, and now he's scrambling here at the end of the offseason to try and make a team. One more quick stat about Arrieta. For some reason, he feels like he's a $100 million player, that he deserves to command that type of money because of his success back in 2015. Hey, Scott Boras, here's a news flash. Jake Arrieta is not the same pitcher as he was in 2015. In fact, he's significantly worse. And to prove that, listen to this tell-all stat about how bad Arrieta has gotten. So in his first 89 starts with the Cubs, he pitched in 566 and two-thirds innings and gave up a total of 30 home runs. That's unbelievable. Very good. In his last 39 starts, he pitched in 236 and a third innings, giving up 31 home runs. That just proves it. It's a tell-all tale of how he has regressed as a pitcher. And now he's sitting here trying to play cat and mouse, assuming that he's going to get some big-time offer. Listen, it's not going to happen. He's gotten much worse as a pitcher, and because of that, no one is willing to pay him what he wants. For Arrieta, if I were him, I'd take what you're offered, or else you may not find yourself on a major league roster come opening day 2018. Sticking with baseball, let's move on and talk about the Chicago White Sox. Right now, two big headlines coming out of camp so far during this inaugural week and a half. First off, the Sox signed someone new, someone to help them in their starting rotation needs, and we talked about that on their last podcast, and they may want to invest in a starting pitcher as their number 4 or 5 to use as a stopgap until all of their prospects are developed. Well, they went out and signed someone familiar, that being Hector Santiago. He's back on the team for a 1-year deal, and as far as I know, he should make the team out of camp and be one of the starting 5 in the rotation. So Santiago, last season, a year to forget. 4-8, a 5.63 ERA in 14 starts. So he was injured part of the season, but when he was on the mound, he was not effective. And although I hate this specific stat, it actually makes sense in this case. His WAR was exactly 0.0. So he literally meant nothing to that Twins team last year that made it into the playoffs and into that wild card game. But the year before, Santiago did okay. 13-10 overall, a 4.70 ERA. And the year before that, he was an all-star going 9-9 on the season. So what will Santiago do for this Sox team? Well, one, he'll provide a stopgap, as we mentioned earlier. He'll eat up innings for this young Sox rotation and serve as a mentor to these younger prospects getting ready for the major leagues. So that's a given. Now, something that could happen if Santiago really tries to apply himself is that he succeeds in a White Sox uniform, which would help all parties involved. Santiago with the White Sox was a reliever during his 2012 season, did awesome, a 3.33 ERA. Then the next season, he served as a starter and reliever, also known as a swingman, and did awesome. The 4-9 record, not so much, but a 3.56 ERA and 149 innings pitched. So he has a track record of doing well with the White Sox and pitching coach Don Cooper. So keeping that in mind, you'd have to hope that he'll do the same or he'll replicate some of that success this year with the White Sox team that is not ready to contend just yet. So when the deal for Santiago was completed, there were two thoughts that went through my mind immediately. First, okay, the White Sox decided to sign someone who they were familiar with to help them with their pitching staff. They needed someone to fill that fourth or fifth spot, so I assumed, okay, Santiago, a perfect guy, not many people going after him, he can reunite with his old teammates and get to work for the team. But secondly, I thought of Carlos Rodon. When is he going to come back? And sure enough, the next day, a report was released about Rodon saying that he will not be back with the team until at least early June. He's sitting out of all Cactus League games as well. Here's what White Sox GM Rick Hahn had to say about the matter. Quote, real pleased with the way things are going. He reports he feels normal. The surgery was a success. His first outings against competition will likely come in extended spring training, which will then be followed by a rehab assignment. His return to the major leagues continues to be on the path that will trend closer to the 8-month mark rather than the 6-month mark. Now, Rick Hahn can try and spin the story any way he wants into his own opinion, but personally, I don't like that. I think Rodon should be back closer to that 6-month mark. That's not a good thing that it's taking him this long to recover. Hopefully, however, once he does get back, he'll be the same Rodon as he was in years past, a Rodon who averaged over 9 strikeouts per 9 innings and has a career ERA just under 4.0. Finally, something a bit interesting that came out of Sox camp is that the team finally solidified their 40-man roster, so they had to make some signings, including Matt Davidson and Tyler Saladino. Davidson's getting $570,000, Saladino's getting $565,000, but it was revealed in this same article, the MLB minimum salary for this season, $545,000 is the number, so it continues to go up year per year. I remember about 10 years ago, it was just at $500,000, so going up by $65,000. I don't know, something interesting to add in to the mix. We'll move on now, talk about some Chicago Bears news. Two main pieces of news that have circulated as the team is in its offseason, OTAs, and the draft coming up soon. First off, there was an interview published with Tariq Cohen. And here's a very interesting quote, something that we want to talk about. So Cohen was asked about Tyreek Hill, and he feels that he is and can be capable of reproducing his success. Quote, when I was at the combine, coaches would always ask me who I would compare myself to in the league, and I would always tell them, Tyreek Hill. I felt like I could do the same things that he does in that Kansas City offense as the team I was going to. And since we have their former coach now, I feel like I've got to live up to that. But I'm definitely looking forward to being that same type of playmaker. Ironically enough, although the statement, of course, is very bold, very verbose, I don't disagree with it necessarily. If you look at Cohen's first-year stats, comparing them to Tyreek Hill's, there are similarities between them. So Cohen this past season, 370 rushing yards, 2 touchdowns, 358 receiving yards and a touchdown, averaging 9.4 yards per punt return and 22.4 yards per kickoff return. Here's Tyreek Hill in his rookie year. Now for kickoffs and punt returns, Hill was very good. Averaged 15.2 yards per punt return and 27.4 per kick return, but had 593 receiving yards, rushed for nothing. Now this season, Hill was a pro bowler as well, but for a different reason, was the main wide receiver for the Chiefs with Alex Smith. Either way though, there are similarities, and I feel like Cohen isn't necessarily wrong for saying that. And by the way, Cohen mentioned, of course, that the Bears now have Matt Nagy, former offensive coordinator for the Chiefs. It'll be interesting to see if Nagy will try to brand Cohen as the next Tyreek Hill. Will Nagy force Cohen to become strictly a wide receiver or strictly a running back? Focus on one thing and get good at it. Those are all very interesting possibilities for Cohen, but either way, all of this ties together. Having Nagy as the new head coach, a guy who worked with Hill exclusively back in Kansas City, means a lot. And I feel like he has the chance to transform Cohen into an all-around superstar, someone like an Alvin Kamara, someone like a Tyreek Hill, who both players, by the way, that I mentioned, made the Pro Bowl this season. On a final note about the Bears, something that's very interesting that happened to a former player. Former Bears quarterback Charles Tillman has become an FBI agent. In September, he had enrolled at the FBI Training Academy in Quantico, Virginia, to pursue a full-time career at the agency, and just as of late, a couple of days ago, he graduated from the academy. He is now officially an FBI agent, and apparently, his interest in law enforcement goes back to his playing days. He occasionally observed and worked alongside law enforcement officials during the off-season months. So congratulations to our former guest Charles Tillman on becoming an FBI agent. That's awesome to hear and really cool considering that even though his career is over, he's still pursuing a passion that he loves. Well, it's time to move on to the Chicago Bulls and congratulations. Start throwing the confetti. Start opening the bottles of champagne. The Bulls are finally starting to tank for real and getting ready to try and get a top 4 or a top 5 pick. Do you not believe me? Hear it for yourself, according to John Paxson, Bulls president of basketball operations. This was a quote he gave Chicago Tribune's KC Johnson at the All-Star break. Quote, we're going to start looking at blocks of games where we'll be having a few guys who haven't been playing much or at all have a significant role. The whole goal in our position is to evaluate what we have on this roster. It's just the position we're in as a young team, 20 and 37, with a lot of young guys and several who we haven't really had the chance to see play much this year. For us to make the proper evaluation in terms of who fits us moving forward, this is something we have to do. And in that same vein, as Paxson stated, look at the guys who are getting minutes right now. Cameron Payne finally coming back, and boy, oh boy, what a bust he is. But nevertheless, he's going to be getting minutes, along with Chris Dunn and Lauri Markkanen, which they're just getting minutes mostly because one's a rookie. Dunn, he's in his second year. They both need minutes at the NBA level to get ready for the future. Then you're getting Denzel Valentine some time. You're also getting Felicio and Noah Vonleh, who the Bulls just acquired in a trade. All of those guys are getting minutes. Ironically enough, all those guys, with the exception of Markkanen, and you can make a case for Chris Dunn, are not worth playing in a situation in which winning was needed. The Bulls are finally realizing that tanking or losing on purpose is necessary for them in order to get a big-time pick. They've already acquired one via the Mirotić trade. They can get one more if they continue to do bad and then start rebuilding from there. So finally, everybody's come to the realization that tanking is needed. Ironically enough, Mark Cuban, owner of the Dallas Mavericks, was fined $600,000 by NBA Commissioner Adam Silver because he endorsed tanking when he said it to a reporter. The quote is as follows. I'm probably not supposed to say this, but, like, I just had dinner with a bunch of our guys the other night, and here we are, you know. We weren't competing for the playoffs. I was like, look, losing is our best option. Now, because Cuban had the stones to say that publicly, of course, he's going to get fined for it. But his philosophy is not wrong. Paxson, on the other hand, he's not going to say anything publicly about it, so he won't get fined necessarily, but look at the players they're deciding to play, and remember the quote that I mentioned about Paxson and the way it was worded. He didn't come out and say losing is our best option, but he said we're going to quote-unquote evaluate players. What that basically means is, for these last 20 to 30 games of the year, the Bulls are going to play players who do not mean anything to them in order to keep losing, drive that winning percentage down to rock bottom, and then get a very good draft pick come this year's NBA draft over the summer. And before we move on and talk about the Blackhawks, one little nugget that I thought was pretty funny, actually, has to do with Bobby Portis. So, we all know now that Paxson is going to start playing players who don't usually get lots of minutes. So, in a game against the Philadelphia 76ers, one that the Bulls lost 116-115, Bobby Portis went off, scoring 38 points. It's a career high. So he had 35 points in the fourth quarter. He had about 7 minutes left, and there were cameras on him. And if you can read lips, he was saying, look, I'm going to get 40. I'm going to get 40, i.e. getting 40 points in the game. This was, again, with like 6 or 7 minutes left when he was at 35. So after saying that, Portis goes on to miss a majority of his shots and ends with 38, can't even get to 40. I don't know, I thought that was hilarious. I saw it on Around the Horn on ESPN. I looked it up to make sure it was all good, and that was something very funny. So, in essence, he jinxed himself, didn't get to 40, and in the end, the Bulls lost by 1 point. But either way, a nice showing by Bobby Portis after getting some regular minutes. And finally, we're going to move on now and talk about the Chicago Blackhawks. Well, last time we talked about them on our last podcast, the team needed to do the unthinkable. They needed to win 22 of their next 30 games in order to make the playoffs. And although there is a very, very slim hope that they can get it done, right now the Hawks are going to be sellers come the trade deadline in the NHL. Wow, I mean, just thinking about it is unbelievable. The last time the Hawks were really sellers and really had nothing to play for come the end of the year was back when Dennis Savard was the coach, before the Hawks ended up getting Coach Q, and the rest was history. But right now, it's not looking good. The Hawks are sellers. They got rid of Michael Kempney, sending him to the Capitals last week for a third-round pick, and they have also waived Lance Bouma. So, both those moves being done, I'm sure there are more to come as the deadline gets closer, but still, it's really happening. The Hawks are actually selling. This is a monumental moment in the franchise. And now you have to wonder, is this the beginning of the decline? Are we going to start seeing the Hawks tear it all down and then rebuild? According to Joel Quenneville and Stan Bowman, they're going to be taking an approach similar to what the Chicago Bulls are doing. The focus over the last 6 weeks will be on youth, with younger players getting larger roles, and Joel Quenneville and Stan Bowman getting a better idea of how they fit in the next season's roster. So, maybe not necessarily a rebuild. Of course, Kane, Taves, some key guys still stay it. But for this season, knowing that the Hawks are not contending, they're going to be looking at players who can supplement and play well with the core of the Hawks' superstar players. So, in the end, although this season did not go the way that Hawks fans and Hawks players and personnel planned, at least they're going to be able to evaluate what they have and look forward to next season. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He grew up right here in the city of Chicago, playing high school basketball and winning a state championship at Whitney Young while playing collegiately at DePaul. He was drafted by the Los Angeles Clippers in the first round of the 2000 NBA draft. He spent 13 years in the NBA, leading the league in three-point field goals during the 04-05 season. Today, he is a scout for the Detroit Pistons and a Jordan brand ambassador. Please welcome Quentin Richardson to the show. Quentin, how are you doing today? Thank you for being here on the show. It's quite an honor.
I'm great. Thanks for having me, John.
So, first off, Quentin, I'd like to take a look back at your amazing basketball career, starting in high school and college. After your state championship at Whitney Young, I'm sure you had many offers from big-time college programs, but in the end, you picked DePaul here in Chicago. So what convinced you that DePaul was right for you, and did your experience there prepare you, in your opinion, enough for the MBA?
The big thing for me, going back to college, going back to high school and picking college, it came down to Kansas and DePaul for me, and I chose DePaul over Kansas because it was a mixture of opportunity to play right in Chicago around my hometown fans and my family and friends, and also I knew that I would be going to school with Bobby Simmons and Lance Williams and the rest of the recruits. We would really have a chance to be good at DePaul, so I felt good about all of those different things.
So, now, you got drafted after leaving DePaul, obviously choosing it because of being here in Chicago, and you immediately began your career with the Clippers. You were also only 20 years old when you made your NBA debut. How was that for you, being able to handle that transition to the NBA at such a young age? You're only 20 years old, playing in a primetime market. What was that experience like for you?
For me, it was great, man. I mean, the fortunate part for me was that I was 19, 20, but I also had like a handful of teammates that were the same age as me. It was 4, 5, 6 of us, with Darius Miles being fresh out of high school at 18, Keon Dooling, Corey McGetty, Lamar Odom. We were all the same age at 20 coming in, and Elton Brand, 21. So, I mean, we had a core group of guys that were all kind of going through the same transition, and we all kind of leaned on each other. We all had different family members out there, so we had a nice support group around us, and we all kind of hung out together and leaned on each other a lot.
So you left the Clippers after 4 years, and you went to the Phoenix Suns only for one season, but that year was unbelievable. You guys weren't even supposed to make the playoffs. You proved everyone wrong. So how magical was that season for you, answering with small hope, but in the end, going to the conference finals?
Man, for us, for me personally, that was like, in the NBA, that was my, as far as team success, making it as far, that was the best season I had in the NBA. So, I mean, for it to start out that way, for us not even projected to go in the playoffs and things like that, and for us to turn it around and do what we did, it definitely was magical and unbelievable. And, it was an unbelievably great, fun year.
And you know what makes it more ironic? You guys weren't even thought of as great, but now everyone finally realizes, if you go on NBA 2K, that 04-05 Suns team, that's in the game as a legendary team. So isn't that pretty interesting as well?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely, I mean, I still, talk to a lot of my teammates from that team all the time. I mean, to a man, myself, Steve Nash, Sean Marion, Amari Stoudemire, Joe Johnson, we all felt like that if we had ample runs at it, or at least another chance at it, that we could have got us one if we'd had a 2-3 stretch run at it. But, we only had that one solid year before that team, because, after that year I left, got traded to New York, and Joe went to Atlanta. So that was like we only had one real try at it with that team.
So following your years with Phoenix and New York in 2009, you were traded a total of 4 times in a period of less than 2 months. Being traded once for some athletes is difficult to process and overcome. So how are you able to deal with the constant trades that occur? I mean, that must have been such a huge distraction for you. You're not even worried about what's going on the court, your own skills. You're worrying about possibly getting dealt once again.
Well, for me, initially when the first deal happens, it's obviously a shock, and you're like, wow, what's going on? But for me, the first trade was a great situation. I thought I was going back to the Clippers, and I was familiar there. I had Coach John Levy there, was still there from when I was there. So I had a lot of familiarities, but then the next trade came, and the next trade came, and the next trade came. So it can be difficult to deal with, and in the beginning, it kind of was, but like, at the end of the day, when you sit down and you think about it, it was like laughable, because it was like, no matter where I end up, I'm going to still have, I still have my contract situated and stuff like that. So it's a lot worse things that could be going on. It was just, it became a situation where it was like focus on just staying ready to play and getting yourself in shape and things like that. And, I knew my agent, Jeff Wexler, would work everything out, which he did at the end.
Well, that's awesome that, you were able to stay tough through all of that. Now, throughout your basketball career, you have been forced to deal with numerous tragedies, all of which I have to say are unthinkable. In 1992, your brother was senselessly murdered, your grandmother died of old age, and your mother died from a battle with breast cancer. I mean, personally, I can't even imagine what kind of a time that was for you. How did you cope during that time and eventually overcome all that to continue playing basketball?
It's a combination of things, man. You know, having a great core of family and good close friends that were around me and that helped me through those times. And then you know, me personally, just persevering. You know, as a young kid at 12 at that age, not really knowing how to process everything, but just trying to, like, I think that's more of a credit to, you know, my sister and my pops and my family and my friends that were around me to help me get through everything. Because, you know, at a young age, you don't really understand everything and you don't really process it the same way as you do once you get older.
So after overcoming all of that tragedy, in 2005, your brother was murdered during a robbery in Chicago. For a fourth time, you had to experience the death of a close family member. So even though you were older and obviously wiser at that time, it still hit close to home. What was different this time around, and how did you overcome yet another tragedy?
I would say that this was probably tougher than, you know, being 12, because, like I say, as an adult, I'm 25, 26, then I understand things a lot more. I was very close to my brother. And, you know, like I said, you just understand things a lot differently, and you're able to process things differently and handle things emotionally differently. So for me, it affected me, I think, a lot worse as an adult than it did as a younger man.
I have to say, just what a story that is. Unbelievable that you were able to overcome all that and still do very well at basketball for those 13 years in the NBA. I wanted to shift gears, take a look at an issue that has made some national headlines. So college players and coaches have been named in a report regarding under-the-table money and under forms of payouts. In your article with the Players Tribune, you noted that you were approached with bags of money, quote-unquote, while in college. How widespread of a problem is the illegal pay of college athletes, and do you see a better solution to the current system?
I don't want to say that, you know, I know the answers to anything like that, but absolutely. When I was in college, you know, agents and things like that, once my name got hot and once I started to do well, you know, I got approached with different things, sums of money, necklace chains and things like that. So those things happen, man. I don't know, you know, it's a tough scenario to try and police everything. I think it's just a tough situation, man, because sometimes, you know, you have kids like that come from a situation where they don't have much, and that money that's being offered, they're not looking at it as like, oh, I'm about to go do something flashy or whatever. Like, this is really going to help provide for my little sister or for my family at home or for whatever. So it's a lot of different situations that go into those things. And, I mean, you know, it's tough. It's tough to police everything. And, I mean, some scenarios, you know, like those kids, like the flip side of it is that those kids make no money, but they make millions and millions of dollars for these universities. So it's somewhere there has to be some type of common place where they can meet, and it could be some type of common ground that's met, because it's completely one side. And I mean, I felt that even when I was in school, when I announced that I was going back to college, you know what I'm saying? Like they had a press conference and all this. So I announced I'm coming back. And then it's like, I was on a season ticket renewal form. So, you know, that's like, that's money. I'm not seeing any of that money. I'm not getting anything from a season ticket renewal. You know what I'm saying? It was like, Q's coming back, are you? Like, that, I remember it verbatim. Like, it was, that was a picture of me from the press conference, and it said, Q's coming back, are you? Season ticket renewal form. You feel me?
Definitely. And I think that's unfair, actually, especially when you put it like that, how colleges are making money off of these players, and yet the players are receiving no compensation. They're just going to school there.
Nothing. And if they take a meal or something, it's like, I mean, I understand you shouldn't get, like, you know, like large sums of money and like cars and all of this different stuff, but like food and, like, you know what I'm saying? Like meals and stuff like that. Like, I'm seeing people getting like I saw the one kid, like, whatever they said, $100,000. That's a big deal. But like, the one kid was on there for like, they was trying to figure out if his parent had a meal with an agent or something, like a meal. Like, y'all gonna, like, make somebody ineligible for having a meal?
Yeah, that's crazy stuff. But it's awesome. When you put it in that perspective, you know, it makes people think about it much differently. So thank you for providing that, because really, others are always thinking about just the money, the sheer money itself, and how people could be using it for the wrong reasons, but small sums like that, you know, why is that being made such a big deal?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I just feel like, you know, it's a situation where it has to be, you know, visited, and the conversation needs to continue about how to come to some type of resolution. Because, I mean, I think it's definitely a slippery slope when they start speaking about paying the kids and things like that. I look at it more as like possibly, I don't know, a back end type deal, because after you see how much that kid's likeness has been used or something, and they trying to sum something up or whatever. But like, cause like every kid isn't going to be used and promoted the same, and everybody gets that. But I mean, it has to be some type of something that can be done.
So speaking of college basketball, today you scout players for the Detroit Pistons. Your cousin Dean has stated in the past that you aspire to be a head coach one day. Have there been any active dialogue about this, and could we be calling you Coach Q in the near future?
Right now I'm really, really enjoying my direction in the front office. I mean, I would never say never to the coaching side of it, just because I love basketball and I love being a part of, you know, the NBA and team sports and stuff like that. So I would never say that it will never happen. But right now, I really enjoy doing the pro scouting and trying to move up in the ranks of the front office.
Now, despite your job with the Pistons, you are still a part of the Jordan brand, and on your Instagram, you released some pictures of your new shoes dropping this weekend. Can you tell us a little bit about them and the story behind that sweet design?
Well, actually, what's happening is the Jordan is kind of relaunching. It's kind of like based around the model that I wore when I was with the Magic. It was a retro, the Air Jordan Retro 13 that when they do a PE, it's called a player edition for it. So like my player editions were in the Orlando Magic colorway. So what they're doing is kind of releasing that shoe and that colorway. It's kind of like the colorway was very popular, so they decided to actually make it and come out with it in that color and release it.
Oh, that's awesome. Aren't you pretty excited? Are you going to be one of the first customers?
It's not like that. I think I'll definitely have the shoe and stuff like that. I mean, I still have my version of it when I had it from the Magic. So, but yeah, I'll get some of the shoes for my family and stuff like that. I'll get the shoes for them.
So, on a final note, in your Players Tribune article, you talked about how as a freshman at DePaul, you guys took down Cincinnati in a crazy double overtime win. Now, you got home from the road trip, you visited your father in Chicago, and his driveway was filled with snow. So, after winning such a huge game and being on national TV, you were outside shoveling your father's driveway. Talk about a humbling experience, huh?
Well, actually, it was a home game. It was a home game. So what, you know, we played at the Allstate Arena. That's on the north side, you know, in the north suburbs. So I live on the south side. So after that game, the game was early day game. And after the game, you know, I would normally go back and forth to my pop's house often after games or during the week or whatever. It was only a 20, 30 minute ride. So I would always do it. And that particular day, it was planned for me to, you know, the snow needed to be shoveled. So it had nothing to do, you know, my pops wasn't like he was trying to feed me any humble pies. And that was just life in a Richardson household. It was normal. It wasn't, he didn't go out of his way to make any point out of it. Like if I brought up this story to him, he literally wouldn't even remember it. Like he read the article, he didn't remember the story because it was just commonplace. We were going, like, that was what he instilled with us. We were going to work, and especially around the house, anything that needed to be done, that was what we were going to do, and that was how he instilled in us work ethic and taught us how to work hard. So, I mean, for me, it was just, you know, it was another day. I mean, the funniest part about the story is that, you know, somebody from the neighborhood coming walking from the corner, so they see me, and they looking like, nah, man, I know, like, come on, man, Mr. Richardson off the hook for this. Like, I just saw you, like, hours ago get carried off the court. Like, you supposed to be on campus being a kid. I said, no, I'm going back. I said, I'm going back. As soon as I get through with this, I'm heading back up there now. So, you know, it was just funny to see it. I mean, anybody that knows, anybody that grew up in my neighborhood that knows, they know that. Like, my father was known in the neighborhood for that. Like, Mr. Richardson don't play. Like, he worked.
Well, Quentin, thank you so much for being on the show. Quite an honor and awesome story there to end.
All right, thanks for having me, John.
What an honor it was to have Quinn Richardson on the show. Great guy, some great stories told in there, and some new perspectives on the NCAA and paying college athletes. Worth a listen. Awesome to have him on. We're going to conclude today with our closing segment, the announcer's call of the day. And you know, I've been a little Cubs biased in the past in regards to this segment, so I'm going to bring up some White Sox highlights for this one. We go to last season. 3-2 New York Yankees lead the Sox at the Cell. Bases are loaded. Two outs in the bottom of the ninth. Jose Abreu at the plate. Let's listen to Jason Benetti, White Sox TV play-by-play man, for the call. What a comeback indeed for the Sox in that game and that clip. Just to remind you, that opening day starts at the end of March. It's right around the corner. Thank you all for listening to today's show. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports. Hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zacks. Thank you again for listening to the show. A special thank you to Quinton Richardson for being on, and have a great day.